Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It is September 9th. And let's take a look at the schedule. So 241, September 9th, we're going to proceed with Chapter 6, Interaction Between Cells and Their Environment today. And we have a lecture next time as well on this chapter, so we got a lot of nice time on this chapter. The 9th, and then a week from today, the 16th, we'll have a lecture, and then 2 weeks from today is your lecture exam, your first lecture exam, on 1, 2, 3, and 6. Those are the chapters. And I have lectures online now for you to listen to. Once again, looks like my recorder is working today as well, so I'll get those up there certainly by the weekend. And I'm also working on those online questions. I'm working with the publisher to see if we can find those questions online someplace. If not, then I'll have to transfer those questions into the 12th and 13th edition of the textbook, which are still online. And I just have to make sure that those questions map back into the exam that you're going to get. I just don't want to throw a bunch of questions at you and see that it's not important because it's not on the exam. So I'll get those going as soon as I can. Does anybody have a question regarding the schedule or any of the online materials before we get started?
I wonder if some of the questions in it still says that it's not found on their website.
Yeah.
Oh, is
that so that's what I'm talking about. There are still a couple links that aren't working in Blackboard, and I'm trying to find another source for those questions. Hopefully they took those questions and put them someplace else. And the publisher is trying to get that information for me.
How many points was the extra credit for the syllabus?
Syllabus extra credit, maybe 1.3, 1.4. But I think I made a mistake on one of the questions. I made it worth 10 points. Something, I don't know. I'll have to look. It doesn't come to mind exactly what it is. Yeah. Okay. So that's questions with regard to the schedule on Blackboard. And don't forget, here's our SI leader right here. Do we have any announcements from SI?
No.
No, okay. Excellent, excellent. Okay. All right, so let's get started with lecture. Last time, we looked at a number of things. We defined what a solution is. All right, who can tell me what a solution is? What's a solution?
Solvent.
Yeah, it's got two compartments. It's got a solvent, which is the fluid part, and then there are solutes, which are things that we dump into the solvent to make a solution. All right, so think of those two things. We say the solution is more concentrated when there are more solutes dissolved into that solution. And I've used a term called concentration gradient last time, and I want to make sure that you all know what a concentration gradient is. Can somebody describe to me what a concentration gradient is? What's a concentration gradient? I'm glad I asked, because I want to know, because we're talking about that a lot. Okay, a gradient just means that if you're in one area, you have a lot of substance, and then if you go to another area, it's not the same. It's a lot less. So it's high concentration in one area, low concentration in another. And so we think of that as a gradient in concentration, because it's low, then a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher, and then really high. That's what a concentration gradient is. And that led us to understand something about diffusion, because now we know what a solute is, and diffusion works based on the concentration gradient. So there has to be a difference in concentration of a solute between two different places in order for those molecules to move. And you should be able to tell me generally what kind of process diffusion is. Does it require energy or does it just happen automatically? It happens automatically without energy. It doesn't require any ATP or any other kind of energy source. All right, and then last time we looked at some things that affect the rate of diffusion, and you should understand these. So the concentration gradient is directly related to the rate of diffusion. If the gradient is large, then the rate of diffusion is fast. If the gradient is very small, if the concentrations in two areas are almost the same, then the rate of diffusion is very, very slow. And furthermore, if the concentration of solutes is exactly the same in two locations, what can you tell me about diffusion or the rate of diffusion? It actually stops, right? In order to have a diffusion, you need a concentration gradient. No concentration gradient, the rate goes to zero. Right. If we increase the concentration gradient because it's directly related, what happens to the rate of diffusion? If we increase concentration gradient, then it increases, right? What about if we change the permeability of the membrane so that it becomes more permeable? What happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well, directly related. If we increase the temperature of a solution, what happens to the rate of diffusion? If we increase temperature, the rate increases because it's directly related. Right? And so you would be able to use that to explain to somebody why the rate increases when temperature increases. Because you could just say, well, they're directly related to each other. Okay? And as the membrane gets bigger in terms of the surface area, we stretch that membrane out, make it really big. What happens to the rate of diffusion when we make the membrane bigger in terms of length and height? The rate increases. And why is that? Because it is directly related, right? Right there. All right, but there is something that does slow the rate of diffusion down, and that is the size of a particular molecule. We call that molecular weight. We could actually measure or calculate what the molecular weight of a compound is by looking at the periodic table and adding those atomic masses together. We could calculate the molecular weight. And as a molecule gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It slows down. Yeah. So maybe one way to think of this, what's our size compared to a molecule?
Huge.
Yeah, we're huge. Okay? And so you could think of that's the reason why we don't diffuse around in the room in lecture, right? We're just too big. We're way, way bigger than a molecule, right? So we're just stationary. So that is diffusion. It's a passive process, so it does not require energy. So let's move on to another concept. This is osmosis. And what are the three necessary criteria for a process to be considered or to fit the definition of osmosis? And here are the answers right here, and I don't want to talk about them right now, but you should have these answers right on the tip of your tongue if you know something about osmosis. All right, so it's the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. Here we have a container, and it's not just one container, it's really two containers, because there's a separation between the left and right side. It's a membrane. And a selectively permeable membrane, which is what we want to talk about, looks like this, the zoomed-in region of the membrane. We see that it has some holes or pores in this membrane, and these pores are just big enough so that the water molecule can move across the membrane if it wanted to. Right? It can fit through these pores. But here is a solute particle, and what can you tell me about this solute particle with respect to the size of that pore? It's way too big. It won't slip through. It can't. So if there's a solute on the left, on the right side of this container, it can't get to the left. If there's a solute on the left, it can't get to the right, no matter what we do. But water can go back and forth. So if we look at this container, right, can you see which side is more concentrated in solute? Which has a higher concentration? It's the right side. I see a lot more dots over here, less on the left side. So is there a concentration gradient across this membrane? Yeah, that fits the definition, right? Concentration gradient just means that it's high in one area, low in another. And if there were no membrane here, which way would these solute particles move? Because that's a nice motive force for diffusion, a concentration gradient. Which way would these particles move? From left to right or right to left? Right to left, down the concentration gradient. Okay, now let's consider the effects of this membrane. The solute can't move across the membrane because it is too big. But the water molecule can. So if we have a lot of solute molecules on the right-hand side, that means that there is less water. These solute molecules are decreasing the concentration of water. And over here, where we have less solute, then there's more water molecules. Here's a high concentration of water. All right, so it's what we're looking at in terms of water is the opposite of these solute particles. Water is high on the left, and then water is low on the right side. So which way would water want to move? Yeah, from left to right, down its concentration gradient, And that's what we see with this zoomed-in region. We see water molecules moving across right to the right-hand side because the right-hand side is more concentrated in solute, which means that there is less water on the right-hand side. All right, because these particles, the solute particles, can't move across the membrane, we call these things osmotically active. They have a special effect on this particular membrane, and it will have a special effect on cells. There are many molecules inside a cell that can't get out because they're way too big. And it has a special effect on the size and the shape of a cell. So what is osmosis? Well, we see water is moving from one place to another, and you see energy being used when water moves across this membrane. Is it active or passive? It's passive, right? So osmosis is passive, and water is going to go from a high concentration to low, and that also means that it's passive. What do we call that when a molecule moves passively from high concentration to low? That's just a fusion, right? So that's the second criteria. And what can you tell me about this membrane? It's kind of special. It's selectively permeable, or you could say semi-permeable, right? Because it lets some molecules through, but not all. Those are the three criteria for osmosis. It has to be diffusion, and, oh, one last thing that I didn't mention. It's demonstrated right here. In order for osmosis to take place, the molecule that diffuses across the selectively permeable membrane has to be the solvent molecule, not the solute. And what's the solvent in our body? It's water. So for a biology class, osmosis requires water moving down its concentration gradient through a selectively permeable membrane. All right, so those are the three criteria. Right, and since it's selectively permeable, that means that there are some solutes that can't get across, and if it can't get across, then that solute is called osmotically active because it can draw water from one area, from one side of the membrane to the other, down its concentration gradient. Okay, so any questions on that? I think just remember passive versus active. Some membranes, right, have special little channels in them. Remember, what's a good way to think of a membrane? What's a good way to think of a membrane? I can't remember. We haven't talked about it yet in this class, I think. Maybe sort of. But a membrane has a lot of lipid in it. And what kind of compound is a lipid? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic, right? So a membrane right here doesn't want to have anything to do with water. So when water bumps into it, it will just bump off. It can't get across the membrane because it's a layer of oil. Unless that membrane has certain little channels or pores built into it, and those little pores or channels we call aquaporins, which means just a water channel or a water pore. All right, so if this is a cell membrane without aquaporins, water can't get across. If it is a cell that has aquaporins built into the membrane, then water can diffuse one way or the other according to its concentration gradient. And we're going to look, actually, the very last week of the class, we're going to look at these aquaporins because it's regulated in a very nice fashion. All right, so let's continue with osmotic pressure. All right, so we need some osmotically active particles in order to have a pressure develop osmotically across the membrane. And we saw in that previous example that water from the left moved into the right-hand side, but these solute molecules can't move one way or the other, so they get stuck over here. And when water moves in, what happens to the volume on the right-hand side? We pour water in there, or water diffuses in there down its concentration gradient, that's going to exert a force on this membrane, right? And it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's going to slide to the left until the pressure is equal across the membrane because those molecules are moving in. All right, so we started with the volumes being exactly the same. Then we let water start to diffuse, diffuses to the right, and when it gets over here, it forcibly increases the volume on the right-hand side. And so the force that we need to push the membrane back to where it was in its initial location, that's what we call osmotic pressure. And that's a really important thing. I'm sure you're going to really appreciate that through this whole class. In this particular case, look what we have on the left side. Pure water, no solutes whatsoever. Right? And over here we have a lot of glucose. So for sure water is going to go from where it's 100% concentration, 100% to where it's relatively low concentration. So water will move from high to low. All right, so and in order for this to work, these solutes can't move across the membrane. All right, so what do we call solutes that can't move across the membrane? Osmotically active. That means that when water diffuses into the cell because of these osmotically active solutes, then the membrane has to be pushed out when water diffuses in. It has to make room for those water molecules moving in to that particular chamber. Okay, so think about that. Ask me some questions, unless you have a question right now. Anybody have a question right now? Okay, what osmotically active means, it's just a particle that can't get across the membrane, and it can help exert some kind of pressure on a membrane if water can diffuse one way or the other. So water is freely diffusible. So what does this membrane have in order for water to diffuse across it? In aquaporins. Yeah, if this is a biological membrane, it would have to have aquaporins in there for water to move across. All right, well, we got a little bit of chemistry that we want to think about right at the moment. We want to be able to talk about the concentration of a solute in a solution. And if we know that, then we can calculate what the solvent concentration is as well. And there's different ways we think about that. We think about it in terms of molarity. We think about it in terms of molality. And we can think about them in terms of osmolality. Three things. That's going to be the next slide. But let's start with the simplest, at least in my view, way of calculating concentration, and that is molarity. All right, so molarity. How do you make a solution to a particular molality? Let's just say we want a one molar solution of something. Well, we need to get a beaker where it's clearly marked where 1 liter is. Right? So if we pour something in here, some kind of fluid, and add solutes, we know that if we fill it to this line, there's exactly 1 liter of solution inside this beaker. And some of these beakers, maybe you've used before, they're relatively expensive because it's difficult to put that line right there. So we take 1 mole of a solute and we put it into this beaker, and then we add enough water to bring it right up to this 1 liter mark on the flask. All right, so there we have to leave some room for that particular solute. And depending on the solute, you might have to add more or less water to make it add up exactly to 1 liter solution. So that's a molar solution. And how would you calculate the, what is a mole of something? How would you calculate that? All right, well, you know what glucose is, and a mole is just a number of particles that we can measure someplace. And here is the number, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd particles makes 1 mole of particles. So if we had a mole of students in here, okay, what would it be like? 10 to the 23rd power. I don't even know what that is. Trillion, 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 trillion. Well, we couldn't all fit in here unless we all shrunk down into a really small size. We might not even be able to fit this many people, a mole of people, on the surface of the Earth. It's a huge number. Right? So we need to take this many particles, put it in here, then add water up to 1 liter. That would be a 1 molar solution because this is 1 mole of particles. Well, we don't want to sit there and count these particles. We can measure it out on a scale, because we know how much every particle weighs, and then we multiply that by this number here, and that would give us the grams that we have to put into that solution, right, to make a 1 molar concentration. So how do we do that? Well, you got to have the chemical formula for glucose. How many carbons does glucose have? Six. Yeah, you should probably be familiar with that. And oxygens, I don't know if you know that or not, but there's going to be 6 oxygens, okay? And then water molecules, let's see, there's going to be 12, and how did I, even without knowing what the formula is, how did I know that? Because it is a carbon hydrate. For every carbon, there's an H2O, which means 2 hydrogens and 1 oxygen. And I know there's 6 carbons, so there's going to be 6 oxygens, 12 hydrogens on that molecule. With the periodic table, you can tell me what the atomic weight of hydrogen is, what the atomic weight of carbon is, what the atomic weight of oxygen, and then multiply that number by how many of those atoms make up that molecule and add them all together. That would give us the, okay, 1 mole in terms of grams of glucose. And then we put this in this beaker and fill it up to 1 liter. That's going to give us a 1 molar solution. Molality is a little bit different. We'll use that same beaker, and it's still going to have a line right at the 1 liter mark. We're going to measure out 1 mole of glucose. It's going to be the exact same weight, right, which is 180 grams, and put it into the beaker, 180 grams into the beaker. And now we're going to get another really fancy flask and measure out exactly 1 liter of water and pour that into the beaker. All right, so the top example, we use less than 1 liter to fill it to the mark, but now we're using exactly 1 liter down here. What's going to happen to this volume? Is it going to be the same? Is it going to measure right up to 1 liter? Or will it be less or will it be more? Okay. All right, so here's the 1 liter mark. After we mix all these chemicals together, it's way up over here. So the volume is greater, right, when we think of something in terms of molality. So there's a difference in molarity and molality. And in this class, we're interested in molality because of the very last concept that I want you to know. Right? And that is osmolality. What makes things important biologically is if they have an effect on the shape of a cell and the pressure inside of a cell. So we're very interested in osmotic properties. And osmolality is something that will help us understand what's going on. It's based on molality. All right, let's look at this this container right here. And again, it's got two sides to it. And we see that water can move across. And in this particular case, sodium chloride can't, right? NaCl stands for sodium chloride. That's just table salt. And on the left, we have glucose, 1 molar solution of glucose. And if all of a sudden then we open up all those aquaporins, right, we started with what? Equal concentrations of glucose and sodium chloride. So if there's equal concentrations of sodium chloride and glucose, that means that the concentration of water is exactly the same across the membrane. So what would happen to water under those circumstances? Okay. Water concentration the same? What can you tell me about diffusion? Okay. If the concentration of water is the same, you know what? No diffusion. Because diffusion is directly related to water concentration or solute concentration. If the concentration is the same, then diffusion goes to zero. Right? I do see some arrows here, but why do we see arrows going from left to right? Well, because when we put sodium chloride in solution, look what happens to it. It dissociates. It forms two particles instead of one. And as far as osmosis is concerned, we're only concerned about number of particles, not what kind of charge they have, how big they are, or anything like that. Right? So what happens then? Well, then the concentration of solute is twice what it is on the left-hand side, right? Because this breaks down into two particles, which means that there is less water on the right-hand side compared to the left. So now we have high concentration of water on the left, low concentration of water on the right, and water is going to move from left to right because the sodium chloride split into two molecules, right? If sodium chloride did not split, then water would not diffuse from one way to the other, right? But in this circumstance, it does. And as water moves in, what has to happen to this membrane right here? It's got to give way, and it gets pushed to the left, right? Until the water concentration is exactly the same. And then we can measure the molarity of glucose, right, and sodium chloride. And what would happen then, that the molarity of sodium chloride drops to 0.75, the concentration of glucose increases to 1.5, but the water concentration, right, is going to be exactly the same, because what is 2.7, what is 2 times 0.75? What's 2 times 7.5? It is 1.5. Right, so the solute concentration is exactly the same, even though the molarity is different. Why is that? Because sodium chloride breaks down into two particles. Right, so the osmolality is twice. So when we are interested in osmotic pressure, we have to be aware of that solute. If it breaks down, if it dissociates into one particle or three or any of those things. Right, so it doesn't matter if it's a cation or an anion. It's just a number of particles. All right. So we see that the osmolality, right, after osmosis takes place, is exactly the same on either side of the membrane, but the molarity, right, or the molality is different. And it's the osmolality that makes a difference, that what we're interested in biology and cell membranes. All right, so you might have to read that over a couple more times, talk to your lab instructor, see me during office hours, right? But you just remember that these are osmotically active particles because they can't get through the membrane. Sodium chloride breaks down into two, so the concentration eventually on the right will be twice compared to the left, which means then it's going to draw water. Water will go from high concentration to low concentration. All right, so is this an example of osmosis that we're just looking at? Okay, so the answer is either yes or no, but it's more important to know if you're right or not. So what are the three criteria for osmosis? It's got to be diffusion, got to be just a passive process. Do you see ATP being used here? Nowhere on this piece of paper, right? So no ATP is being used. So, and we see water going from high concentration to low, so that defines diffusion, right? Diffusion going from high concentration to low. And what else? It's got to be a selectively permeable membrane so that there are osmotically active particles. And indeed, this membrane does not allow sodium or chloride, it does not allow glucose, but it does allow water. So here is a selectively permeable membrane. So this is a really good example of osmosis because it is the solvent molecule, there's a selectively permeable membrane, and that solvent molecule just goes down its concentration gradient without the use of any energy, which we call diffusion. All right. Well, here's a pretty important page. This is real important. Tonicity. Right? Tonicity is the effect of a solution on the osmotic movement of water. That's kind of funny. Osmotic movement of water, and osmosis are kind of the same if you have a selectively permeable membrane. Here are three ways that we can talk about a solution depending on its tonicity, whether it's going to have an effect on the size of a cell. We can say it's isotonic, hypertonic, or hypotonic. And here are some really good definitions of that, but I think I want to just do three experiments on the board, and you can tell me what's going to happen. All right, so we're going to have three beakers. Three beakers. Okay, so here is case number one. Here's beaker number two. Here's beaker number three right here. And we're going to put different solutions inside these beakers, but in every beaker, we're going to put a red blood cell. Okay, does that look like a nice red blood cell? That's pretty close, except it's not red, right? Okay, the concentration of salt pretty much in all cells is going to be 0.9%. Wow, this marker might work. 0.9%. So what's the concentration of, I didn't put down here, what is that? NaCl. That's the concentration of NaCl. So what's the concentration of water inside this cell? It's everything else, which is what? 99.1%. So there's a lot more water inside the cell than salt. And in this particular case, let's put something inside the solution. Let me think. What do we want to do? Oh, let's just put pure water. Pure water. All right, so what's the concentration of water here in terms of a percentage? It's going to be 100%. What's the concentration of NaCl? It's going to be zero. All right, so that's water, and NaCl is zero. Okay, sodium chloride can't move across the membrane, so we're not so interested in that number and that number. Water can, right? And which way does water go? From high concentration to low concentration, you're right. What's a higher concentration, 100 or 99.1? Yeah, the higher concentration is 100. Does that look like a big difference right there? It looks pretty tiny to me. All right, but nonetheless, water will move into the cell, down its concentration gradient. And under these circumstances, so much water is going to move into the cell that it's actually going to explode the cell, which means the cell is dead then. And then you don't have red blood cells, so that's not a good thing. All right, so what do we call that? when we break apart a cell or break apart a molecule. It's got a fancy name in biology. Yeah, it's called lysis, right? So, and since this is a red blood cell, we've got a lot of hemoglobin in there, we call that hemolysis. Hemolysis is the breaking apart of this red blood cell. All right, so we got hemolysis taking place. Hemolysis, and the kind of solution that produces hemolysis, okay, is a hypotonic solution. Let's go to another case. Here we have that nice red blood cell, and we have 0.9% sodium chloride, which means we have 99.1% water. And in this solution, okay, or this beaker outside the cell, we're going to have 0.9% salt and 99.1% water inside the fluid right here that the cell is suspended in. So remember, water can osmose down a concentration gradient because it's just diffusing, right? So what's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? They're the same. So water, and what happens to diffusion then when there's no concentration gradient? It stops, right? It goes to zero. So the shape of this cell doesn't change. Water doesn't go in or doesn't go out, so it doesn't accumulate in one side or the other. Right? The cell stays the same shape. This is what we call an isotonic solution. We got one more case. Let's put that red blood cell in there. How much water is inside that red blood cell? 99.1%. Now, let's put this in salty water, maybe seawater or something. And let's just say that we have salt concentration of maybe 5% NaCl, which means what's the water concentration? 95%. Okay, water, H2O. All right, so now, what can you tell me about osmosis? Got to be diffusion. Diffusion means high to low, right? So what's higher, 99.1 or 95%? The higher is 99.1, so water is going to go down the concentration gradient just like that. And so the volume of this cell is going to decrease, and it's going to get all crinkled up. We don't call that hemolysis, we call that crenation. That cell will crenate. It's going to look all shriveled up, and I think you'll do this in lab. You'll actually look at these cells. You might even do this in lab, but when you look at it, will you see any cells? No, it's not going to be very interesting to look at because there's nothing to look at. It's just going to be looking like red Kool-Aid or something, okay? But these cells are going to be all shriveled up. This process right here, okay, we got hypotonic, isotonic, and here is hypertonic solution. Now, if you get an IV, you think it would be important for somebody to know whether or not that solution that they're putting in your blood, for whatever reason, maybe bringing your blood volume up, should they know if it's a hypotonic, isotonic, or hypertonic solution? Yeah, because if somebody made a wrong calculation and transfused a hypotonic solution into your blood vessels, what's going to happen to all your blood? All the cells are going to explode, and your blood is going to look like Kool-Aid instead of a living tissue, and that will be the end of you. And after these cells hemolyze, can they ever go back to looking like a normal cell? No. When something blows up, that's it. That cell can never come back. So that's another way of thinking about an irreversible process. Now, what about if we put this red blood cell in a hypertonic solution and it ended up all kind of crinkled like that? Can this crenated cell ever go back to a normal cell? Normal looking cell? It's a nice trick question. Okay, you could probably take a guess. And I'll say yes, it can go back to looking like this cell over here. How would we do that? How could you do that? You take this poor crinkled up cell and do what? You put it into a solution that is isotonic. And then the concentrations will just magically equal out. The water will move into the cell and will re-expand that cell, and it will stop exactly, okay, at its original shape and size. So these are really important considerations. Now, how can I remember this? Well, it's easy to remember isotonic. It's just the tonicity inside the cell. Concentrations of water and solutes are exactly the same. How do I know? Well, I'll tell you how I know it, but it's kind of a stupid way. So it might help you, but you can't tell anybody that I taught you this. Okay? So it's like a secret. All right? I see an O, right, in hypotonic. All right, and there's an O in hemolysis, right? Just like this. Ah, how about that? Ooh, nice, nice. And in crenation, what do we have? We have an E in hypertonic, and we have an E in crenation. Well, nobody's groaning. Nobody's throwing anything at me. That's good. All right, well, this will help get you through at least the test, right? And maybe even for a year or two. But if you maybe write it out once or twice, you'll probably know that it will haunt you for the rest of your life. All right, sorry about that, but it will help you get through the test. All right, so here is the figure that's in your textbook that shows what happens to this nice red blood cell. Is it being projected? Yeah, it sure is. Okay. If it's put in a hypertonic solution, what does it do? Hypertonic, it. Does it hemolyze or crenate? It crenates. If we put it in a hypotonic solution, it will hemolyze. And this picture right here doesn't show a hemolyzed cell because they wanted to put something there. They just didn't want to put a blob of red stuff, right? So actually this cell would actually burst. All right, so do the above processes qualify as osmosis? All right, does crenation and hemolysis qualify as osmosis? What molecule is moving? Water. That's the solvent molecule, so that's criteria number one. And how does it move? From high to low, does that require energy? No, that's the definition of diffusion, right? So it has two criteria. Now what about this membrane right here that makes the membrane of the red blood cell? Is it selectively permeable? It is, because sodium chloride, wherever that is, cannot move across. All right, and if sodium chloride cannot move across the membrane, how do we talk about those solutes? They are osmotically active, right? So they can change the shape of cells because they can't get across. Okay, that's some really nice basic physical chemistry that you've got to know about. And your body goes through a lot of pain just to make sure that the concentrations of water inside your body are exactly right. And when it does, then we maintain homeostasis as a result. So how do we maintain homeostasis? Blood osmolalities maintain within a narrow range, 300 milliosmolar. That's what it is, pretty much by definition. I didn't write that on the board, I just used percent. If dehydration occurs inside somebody's body, right, then this osmolality decreases. Right? If dehydration occurs, if dehydration occurs, you're losing water, which means you have more solutes in your body. This osmolality increases. Your body becomes more salty when you dehydrate, right? And so now you're moving away from homeostasis. There are osmolality receptors in your brain, namely the hypothalamus, and your brain, of course, can affect a whole bunch of different areas in your body. So these receptors then send the information to the integration center, which is right there in the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus compares that information to what? A set point, right? And then it sees that there's an error, and the hypothalamus can make a decision on what to do, and its decision is to release antidiuretic hormone. So let's see what's happening here. So here we have dehydration. Blood volume decreases when you lose water. Plasma osmolality increases, which means that your plasma becomes more salty when osmolality increases. All right, so how can your body understand that there's a change in osmolality? How can you tell that I turn the lights on? You have a receptor, right? So there's a receptor in the hypothalamus, osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, compares to the set point, makes a decision. The decision that it makes is to increase ADH secretion from the posterior pituitary. And from anatomy, you probably remember that there is a tract there are neurons that go from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary. And at the end of those neurons, they can either release oxytocin or antidiuretic hormone, but in this case we're talking about ADH, and that ADH is released into the blood, so we almost consider ADH a hormone, and it goes everywhere in the body because it's in the blood, in particular to the kidneys, right? And that will put certain aquaporins in the kidneys so that water will be reabsorbed from urine and goes back into your blood. Right, so you increase water retention as a result of antidiuretic hormone release from the posterior pituitary. Right, so let's look at this word, antidiuretic hormone. Why is that really not too hard to remember? Because what does a diuretic do? What does a diuretic do? It makes you pee. Yeah, diuretic makes you pee, right? Nice first line of defense for hypertension. Right? But if you take an antidiuretic, then you retain water. Right, so that decreases urine volume, right? So urine will become highly concentrated in salt and a very small volume because your body is holding on to that water. Right, so increased water retention. The other thing that the hypothalamus does, because your brain is, well, it's right in the brain, right? It's going to send signals, all right, to your thirst center and give you the sensation that you're thirsty. And when you're thirsty, you have it, yeah, if there's water available, you'll drink or other kinds of fluids. Right, so you increase water retention, increase water intake. How does that relate to the initial stimulus? Right, if we increase water in our body, our blood volume goes back up. The plasma osmolality decreases because now you have the same number of solutes but a lot more water. So what can you tell me about this response loop? Nice negative feedback mechanism, okay, due to thirst and antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary. So I'll be talking about some hormones throughout the class. If you need to go back and review your hormones from anatomy, that would be okay. But we got a whole chapter about hormones, but it might be a good idea to know a little bit about them so that when I talk about them in lecture, it just it doesn't go like, oh, I've never heard of that thing before, right? But kind of be familiar with that. How many different parts does the pituitary have? It's got two. What are the two parts? Anterior and a posterior. The posterior releases ADH and oxytocin, and the anterior a whole bunch of other kinds of hormones, like gonadotropins, thyroid-stimulating hormone, right? And they're released by a little bit different kind of mechanism because the anterior pituitary is glandular tissue. It's an actual gland. The posterior pituitary is really part of your brain. Part of the nervous system, but they come together right there, and so it's a complicated kind of organ. What was I going to say? Oh, pituitary. Where's that posterior pituitary located, if you're going to describe to somebody, with regard to cranial bones? Cranial bones, trying to get you flashing back to the past. It's in the sphenoid bone, right? And there's a fossa in the sphenoid bone right smack in the middle called the sella turcica, Turkish saddle, because it looks like a saddle that somebody would use to ride a horse with, right? And that's where that pituitary gland is. So you might have a picture in your textbook. Okay, let's talk about some membrane transport systems. All right, and I'm going to zoom ahead just a little bit. All right, what I see right here, oh, we did talk about this kind of magic molecule, right? These are all phospholipids. Phospholipids will make this certain bilayer like this, and this would be a good example of a cell membrane. So these would be fatty acids poking to the interior space of a cell membrane. Here are the phosphate groups that want to be associated with the water, both the intracellular and extracellular water, right? And remember, these membranes can almost like self-assemble themselves just because of they're either hydrophilic or hydrophobic. Nonetheless, think of this as being a very solid and continuous hydrophobic region, right? Because they're all just fatty acids. All right, so if this is the fatty region of a membrane, can water move across it? No, right? Because it's hydrophobic. It's a big hydrophobic region. All right, but sometimes we want to bring molecules across that can't just diffuse across because they are polar compounds. They're like to dissolve in water. They can't get across the membrane because there's no water inside the membrane. It's an oil. It's like a saran wrap that separates intracellular and extracellular. So, it will need a carrier. molecule. So we call this carrier-mediated transport. So molecules that are too large or too polar because they can't get through that lipid layer, right, to diffuse in, they have to be transported across by some kind of protein that's put into the membrane. And we're going to call that a carrier protein. And in order for a molecule to be moved by a transporter, they have to bind to the membrane protein first before they're transported. So you could think of a carrier molecule as almost like being a receptor. And so how does a molecule that's being transported, how does it know to bind to a carrier molecule? It is by shape, right? So the molecule that's being transported has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor so that they can fit together. If they can't fit together, then this transport system is not going to operate. And maybe you could think of maybe like a hand and glove kind of example, or maybe a lock and key example. How can a key open up a lock? How can it turn a lock? It has to have the right shape, right? It's got to have the right number of wiggles in it and the right number of teeth. And if it's got all that, then it can fit in the lock and then it can turn the lock over. Same thing for these carrier-mediated transport. The molecule that's being moved has to have the right shape so that it can bind. All right, so what are some ways that we think about carrier-mediated transport? We got three ways. There's specificity, competition, and saturation. So we have proteins in the membrane, and it's specific because only molecules with a specific what can bind to the carrier transporter. It has to have the specific shape, right? And if that shape changes, right, then the function changes, a molecule won't be transported. So it's got to have the right shape. So let's take a look at this graph. And I don't think I told you how you should read a graph, but there's one thing that you should look at a graph before anything else so that you know what's going on. Okay? You have to look at the axes and how they're labeled. And I see two axes on this particular graph. And what are we comparing? We're calling the rate of transport of some particular solute molecule. We're just going to call it X. So the rate of transport, right, across the membrane, because that's what we're talking about, and how that relates to the concentration of X in solution on one side of the membrane. So as we increase the concentration, what happens to the rate of transport? I tell you what, let's start here. Let's just say that there's no X on the outside of the cell. What happens to the rate of transport if there's no X? Well, if there's nothing there, then nothing can be transported, right? So here we have zero. We have concentration of X being zero. How about the rate? It's zero. That's easy to see for me. And as you increase the concentration of X, what happens to the rate? Look at this solid line right here. Does it stay the same? No. Does it decrease? No. It increases. Right? And so what do we call that? That's directly related. That's nice, right? So if we increase the concentration of X because it's directly related, the rate of transport increases. But does that happen forever? Look out over here. If we increase the concentration way out over here, what happens to the rate of transport? It levels off. Okay? It doesn't increase after a certain period of time. Okay. So we see that it is directly related, but if we put so much of X in solution, it levels off. That's what we call saturation. All of the binding sites are now filled with that molecule, all filled with X. So even if we increase X, we can't increase how many are bound to a transporter molecule because they're already bound up. Right? We call that saturation. And one way to think about what that saturation limit is to look at this transport maximum. Right, and so the transport maximum is just the level of a particular solute, right? And if we increase the concentration of that solute, then the transport does not increase after that. All right, so this is interesting because, for instance, let's just think about glucose, blood glucose concentration. Okay, should that be tightly regulated in your body? Or should it go up? Should it go down to zero? Should it get really high? What do you know about glucose concentration in the blood? Yeah, it's got to be regulated. If it's not regulated, what do we call that condition? That disease? Yeah, it's diabetes mellitus, right? Okay, somebody with diabetes mellitus that is uncontrolled, their blood glucose, right, is very high. It's very, very high. And that glucose is going to get into the kidney, it's going to get into the urine, and you're going to actually void that glucose from your body because the concentration is so high. You'll have glucosuria, glucose in the urine. That's a pathological condition when somebody has diabetes mellitus. That's uncontrolled. All right. That's bad for a number of reasons. One reason is because glucose is an important energy molecule, and gas is the important energy molecule in your car. Would you throw gas away? Would you drive down the street and take a can of gas and just throw it out your window? No, because it's too expensive, right? So same thing for glucose. Your body wants to recover all the glucose from urine that it can, but if your glucose concentration is so high, the transport carriers can't take all the glucose that's in urine and put it back into the blood. And if it can't take it out of the urine, put it back in the blood, where does it stay? In urine, and then you void that from your body and you lose all of that energy, right? So that's one of the problems with diabetes mellitus that is not controlled, because all the carriers are saturated. So we'd like to know what this transport maximum is. Okay, and specificity we talked about already. Just the shape has to match up to the shape of the X has to match up to the shape of the receptor for it. Okay, now what about competition? Well, let's take a molecule X and let's put another molecule, right, that has almost the same shape, right, very close in shape, which means what if it has almost the same shape, or even exactly the same shape, but it's a different molecule. Can it bind to the carrier protein? Can it bind to the receptor if it has almost the same shape? And the answer is, okay, yes. Okay, the more it's like the shape of X, the easier it is to bind. The more it changes from the shape of X, then it has a harder time binding, okay? But it's a very close tolerance. This Y molecule can't have much of a difference in shape because of what? Specificity. But if there's a really minor change, right, then it can bind to the receptor. So now we got two molecules, X and Y, two species of molecules that can bind to that receptor. So what happens to the transport of X when both of these, when both X and Y are there? Y can bind. It will take that receptor site away from X, right? And so then the rate of X moving across the membrane decreases, right? And so we call that competition. So if there are molecules with almost the same shape, they can inhibit this particular process. Right? So that is competition. Specificity, competition, and saturation. These are also going to be important for when we look at an enzyme. Right, so we're talking about a carrier molecule right now, but we're going to use these same concepts to understand something about an enzyme. All right, so let's look at a particular protein that's in a membrane. Here we have, right, a cell membrane. Sometimes we think of this in terms of the phospholipid bilayer, so the lipid part is on the inside. A better way to understand membranes in living cells is with the fluid mosaic model. Fluid mosaic model means that the fluid part is the phospholipid. This is not a very strong kind of membrane, right? It's a very weak. It can bend and wiggle around. That's the lipid part. I mean, that's the That's the fluid part of fluid mosaic model, right? The phospholipid bilayer is a fluid part. And what's the mosaic part? Other things that we add to that, other pieces like this protein that's embedded in the membrane. That's part of the mosaic. So fluid mosaic model is really a better way to think of a cell membrane. Notice that this protein sometimes is open to the extracellular side, sometimes it's open to the intracellular side. Kind of acts like a teeter-totter almost. But in any case, is it open to both sides at the same time? No. Right, it's only open to one side, which means it's got to be closed to the other side, and it can change shape. Remember, we call that conformation. So this protein changes conformation depending on whether something is bound, right, to this binding site. And what's the shape of this binding site? Kind of looks like a stop sign. What's the shape of this glucose molecule? Kind of looks like a stop sign, right? So this glucose can fit into this binding site. Right, and when it does, it changes the conformation of this protein. So now it closes to the outside, it opens to the inside, and what can glucose do now? It can move to the inside of the cell. Right, and how does it go? It goes from what kind of concentration? high concentration to low. What do we call that when something goes from high concentration to low?
Diffusion.
That's diffusion, yeah. So, but in this case, glucose can't get across because glucose is polar. Here's that nonpolar region in the middle of the cell, can't move across all by itself. It needs this special transporter, and then it can diffuse in. We call that facilitated diffusion. Is energy needed? Is ATP needed for this process?
No,
diffusion does not. There's no ATP. All right. So just by binding, just but when glucose binds to this protein, it changes the conformation. Okay. Well, how could you think about that? It's a very low energy when glucose binds to that protein. Like, for instance, take your fingertip, okay, and, I don't know, scratch your nose. Okay. Does that move your body very much? No, it's a very light kind of pressure. Now take your fingertip, use that same amount of pressure, turn to the person on your right, and poke them in the side. What's going to happen to them? You might get slapped, I'm not sure, but that's a much bigger reaction, right? You're going to get out of the way. So small kinds of changes, right, can cause major changes in the conformation of protein. So think of this as like somebody poking this protein molecule in the side, and it's going to jiggle around. Enough so that glucose can move inside the cell. So this is a transporter for glucose, and it only works when glucose is high on one side and low on the other. What happens to this process when glucose is exactly the same? It stops, right? Diffusion stops. All right. So glucose by itself can't get inside of a cell, which means then this cell is going to starve to death if glucose can't get in. Even if there's just gobs of glucose in the blood, the cell is still going to starve because it doesn't have this transporter. So how do we regulate, or how did not we, but how does your body regulate whether or not cells can absorb glucose from the blood, which keeps them alive, which keeps what maintains blood glucose homeostasis? Well, here is how it does it. These proteins are pretty complicated. In order to make these proteins, it might take you a week to do that. Well, how would you like to regulate blood glucose? By week or much quicker than that, right? From meal to meal or when you're fasting. Well, these cells make these transporters all the time, and then it puts it into a vesicle. A vesicle has the same membrane structure as the cell membrane, right? But when they're in this vesicle, they're not allowing glucose to enter the cell, right? Because they're in this vesicle. This vesicle that is holding these proteins in reserve, we call that an endosome. Right, so you know something about a lysosome probably, peroxisome maybe, we'll talk about that. And an endosome is just a special vesicle that holds membrane proteins in the cytoplasm until such time that this vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, these membranes fuse together, and then where do you have these proteins? You have them now embedded in the cell membrane, and they can go about doing their job. So how many proteins did that process add to the cell membrane? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right? So the transport of glucose went increased. Well, it's hard to calculate because it was at zero before, right? So it increased 5 times because of these things. Right? Glucose can now enter the cell. When glucose enters the cell, what happens to blood glucose? It decreases. All right? And you know the name of the signal that allows the insertion of these transporters into the cell membrane. There's a signal outside the cell, and I think you all know what it is, but probably not making the connection just yet. That signal is called insulin. Okay? When your blood glucose is high, insulin is secreted. The cell then has that insulin signal. Then it takes these vesicles or these endosomes, and it puts the glucose transporters into the cell, and now the cell can take up glucose from the blood, maintaining blood glucose homeostasis. And what is the beauty of that? It's a rapid process. Right, because all these proteins are made already. They're just waiting for that end, that insulin signal. If you had to build all of these proteins, then it would take a week, and then how about homeostasis during that whole time? You'd be in a diseased state. Right? So this is a really handy way of allowing glucose to enter a cell. Okay. Well, that's passive, right, from high to low. Let's talk about an active process. And in an active process, in most cases, right, you want to look for an ATP molecule. And do you see an ATP molecule anywhere on this slide? I do see one right here. Okay. So here we have a solute, and it's going to be calcium, and you know that's an ion. You could write out the orbital structure for calcium and see that it is, really is a plus 2 cation or a 2 cation. And since it is a polar compound, can it get through the membrane by itself since it has electrical charge? It can't because of this fatty region on the inside. Calcium cannot diffuse, so you need a transporter to get calcium through this particular membrane. And we see it low inside the cell, high outside the cell. You'll memorize that sooner or later. So how can the cell get calcium out and put into this extracellular space? It's going to need energy to go from low concentration to high concentration. And here is a transporter. It also has an enzyme that can hydrolyze ATP, which means what? Break it down into two smaller molecules. And when it's broken down, it releases energy. And when it releases energy, it changes the conformation of this particular protein to where at the beginning it was open to the inside of the cell, so calcium could diffuse into this protein. And then ATP binds to a receptor site here. It's hydrolyzed because that's an ATPase. That releases enough energy. That's like poking your friend in the side with at least 2 fingers, maybe 5 fingers, right? A lot more energy is released. It can cause a big change in conformation. And now you have calcium, because that protein is open to the extracellular space, moves into the extracellular space, going from low to high concentration, and that's what we call active transport. And in your notes, you should probably put down right in this area right here, we're going to call this primary active transport. We're going to look at some other secondary active transport mechanisms, but if you see ATP being used directly, we call that primary active transport. And it's going to be on the graph, you'll see it, or the illustrations very nicely, because you'll see that ATP. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, what do you get? Who can tell me what kind of molecules you get? You get ADP and inorganic phosphate. Oh, you memorize this functional group right here. Was that a PO4 group? That was one of the things that we looked at when we were in the chemistry chapter. Okay, so ATP, I don't know if we've looked at ATP, maybe not even in anatomy. ATP stands for triphosphate, adenosine triphosphate. So on ATP, there are 3 phosphates all bound together. When it's hydrolyzed into ADP, you have 1 left over inorganic phosphate that can float around in solution. And so now you no longer have 3 phosphates on this adenosine. How many do you have? You have 2, because that's what di means, right? Adenosine diphosphate, there are 2 phosphates. And that covalent bond right there is a high energy bond that is released when ATP is hydrolyzed. So when something goes from low concentration to high using ATP, we like to call it a pump, right? So if you're out camping someplace and you want to fill your canteen up with water and you know there's a lot of groundwater, what do you look around for? You look for a pump. Anybody ever see a pump? There's a big pipe that goes down into the ground. It has this lever, and you push on that lever, and that moves water from low to high so that you can drink. You call that a pump. That's why we call this a pump, because calcium goes from low to high. Primary active transport with ATP. All right. Really quick look at this slide right here. Is this passive or active? Active. And what kind of active process? Primary active transport, because I see an ATP being hydrolyzed. Now, in this particular case, what was on the other one? Calcium? Yeah, calcium was there. In this particular case, we got 2 other ions. We've got, what's this one here? How are you guys doing on your chemical symbols? Sodium. What's this right here? Potassium. Yeah, sodium and potassium. Okay, and where is, just by whether it's being bold or not bold and really large letter and small letter, that represents the concentration. If it's bold, it means it's high. If it's not bold like this, it means it's low. All right, so where is potassium in a normal cell at a high concentration? Inside the cell. That means it's low outside. What about for sodium? Opposite way. It's high outside the cell and low inside the cell, and you might be wondering why that is, and that's because there's a pump. What does a pump need? It needs ATP for primary active transport. All right, and when this protein is operating, It has to bind a potassium from the outside, has to bind a sodium from the inside. When ATP is hydrolyzed, then it's kicked to the other side of the membrane. Now, this is sort of strange. When this pump works, right, it's going to kick three sodiums out, but not the same number of potassiums in, only two potassiums in. Right, so it's a little bit asymmetrical. Right, and since it's ATP, it's going to move against the concentration gradient in both cases, but it's still a pump because it uses ATP. And so we call that the sodium-potassium ATP pump sometimes. And of all the food that you eat, all the energy that you consume, this particular pump consumes most of that energy in your body because all of your cells have these everywhere and they're always working and they're always doing what? They're always using up ATP. And so you got to make that ATP with those mitochondria. We're going to look at that really soon. So most of the energy that you need just to stay alive is to run this particular pump. That's kind of a strange concept, but it's interesting to think about. All right. Well, what can you tell me about these compounds, potassium and sodium? They're special. What's special about them? What makes them different from maybe a glucose or a fatty acid? They have this charge on them, right? And how would you talk about this charge? Potassium is a monovalent cation, right? It has a positive charge. Same thing for sodium. It has exactly the same charge as this potassium. They're both cations. And since they have that charge, what kind of charge is that? That's a strange question. It's what? An electrical charge. It's an electrical charge. And when sodium moves from one place to another, you can consider that an electrical current. Right? And so we're very electrical beings because we have these electrical currents taking place in our body all the time because these ions are being manipulated over and over and over again. So you're just like a, if I say transistor radio, do you know what a transistor radio is? You're like a CD player, okay? Because you need these electrical properties made by these ions right here. All right, so here we have that cell membrane. Because potassium and sodium are polar, they can't get across the membrane. That's why these pumps are there. Right. But when three potassiums move out, remember it's an electrical thing, and two potassiums move in, what happens to the charge, okay, across the membrane or actually inside the cell? When more positives are kicked out of the cell than are brought in, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Does it stay the same? It becomes a little bit more negative. You're right. It becomes a little bit more negative because you're kicking out three positive charges, but only two come in. Two plus three does not add up to zero, right? Okay. Or two minus three doesn't add up to zero. So this is a really interesting pump. So when it's working all the time, right, it makes the inside of the cell more negative compared to the outside. And do you have any devices where it's more negative on one side and positive on the other? And I bet some people know, it's called a battery, right? A battery has two poles on it. One pole is going to be negative compared to the other one, which is positive, right? And what can you tell me about positive and negative charges? They attract each other, right? Okay. So since they have that attraction, it's an energy source, right? So there's a gradient of charge across the membrane. That is an energy source. And somebody said beautifully last time, what is energy? It gives something the ability to do work. So this pump right here, right, just stores that energy in ATP and it can be used for other reasons. And we're going to look at some of these other reasons later on in the class. So every cell in your body acts like what? Acts like a, this is strange, acts like a battery, right? And do you have any other batteries? I got a couple of batteries. I got a cell phone. I got a little transmitter here, right? We use batteries all over the place for energy purposes. And so does every cell. Okay, and this is an example of primary active transport. If the charge in a cell, okay, goes to zero, if the charge is the same across the membrane, what could you tell me about that cell? You have a battery, and both terminals on the battery are exactly the same. What could you tell me about that battery? It's dead, right? A dead battery, there's no electrical separation. If you have a cell membrane where no electrical separation takes place, the electrical charge is exactly the same. What could you tell me about that cell? It is dead. Okay. And maybe it's because it ran out of ATP. and then that cell is dead. So that's how important that membrane potential is, or that membrane voltage. All right, primary active transport. There's another kind of active transport that we call secondary, right? But it's still active transport. So if it's secondary active transport, does it require energy?
Yeah,
it still has to have energy from someplace, but if it's secondary, it's not directly, okay, using ATP. It's using some other source of energy. We just looked at one. All right, so let's look at this graphic here, see if I can explain this to you. Here we have a sodium molecule, or sodium atom, right? And here we have it at low concentration, and we're going to move it from someplace, from low concentration to high concentration. Will that happen automatically when something goes from low to high concentration? No, that's active transport. And in this particular case, moving up this ramp, and it's a gradient just for the analogy, right, we say it is primary active transport. If it's primary active transport, what should have somebody really drawn in right here? If it's primary active transport. An ATP molecule being hydrolyzed to ADP and inorganic phosphate, right? So this requires ATP for sodium to move up the concentration gradient. And when it's up here, right, does it really just love to stay there? Or if you tip it over to the side, what's going to happen to it? It's going to fall off, right? It's going to want to just go from high concentration to low. What do we call that process? From high concentration to low. That's just diffusion, right? And it happens automatically. So the sodium will want to diffuse. So let's give it a little kick, right? And let's get diffusion started. So we're going to kick it off this tabletop right here, and it's going to fall to the floor. And down on the floor, we have this teeter-totter. Okay? And it hits the end of the teeter-totter. What happens to this end of the teeter-totter when this weight falls on it? It's going to go down. And here is a special membrane protein, right? Kind of diagrammed as a teeter-totter, and when this end flips down, what happens to the other end? It flips up. And on this other end, there's a receptor for glucose, and so glucose is going to be tossed up in the air, but as you go up in the air like this, what is that? Going from low concentration to high concentration. All right, so do you see any ATP being used for glucose to go up directly? Is ATP used directly right here? It's not being used directly, but nonetheless, glucose goes from low concentration to high. You know that is an active transport process, and where does that energy come from? The sodium gradient. As sodium goes down its concentration gradient, then glucose can go up its concentration gradient. So secondary active transport relies on, primary active transport relies on ATP for that to happen. So remember, there is energy in a gradient of something. If it's a gradient of electrical charge, then you call that a battery. Right? If it's a gradient of chemicals, it's still a source of energy. Right, so here you can easily see secondary active transport because there's no ATP. Over here, primary active transport because on your slides you drew in an ATP molecule. Okay, you should have an ATP molecule there. All right, so that's the big difference between primary and secondary active transport. Here I see some transports. When do we stop? 12:45? Yeah? Okay, great. Hope I didn't turn the recorder off. Something clicked. Okay, secondary active transport right here. How do we know this is all secondary active transport? Well, here we have, does it say? Glucose, I see glucose on the outside, but I don't see any glucose on the inside. So here is high on the outside. Here is low on the inside. Where is sodium high? This we'll have to remember. You'll have to memorize this. It's high on the outside. Sodium is low on the inside. So there's a gradient of sodium, and what is that? That's a energy source, right? Do you see ATP being used here? No. What about here? No. Here? No, here, no. Can that be primary active transport? It cannot, because there's no ATP. This is an example of secondary active transport. So sodium going from high concentration to low can take all the glucose that's in the solution and put it inside the cell, even though glucose is at a high concentration, right? So if glucose goes from low to high, that's got to be active transport, right? From low to high, active transport. And this is secondary because there's no ATP. It's the movement of sodium that brings glucose inside the cell. If sodium and glucose go in the same direction, okay, we call that co-transport. I actually like the term symport, when two molecules go in the same direction, but it's got to be secondary active transport. There are times when maybe sodium goes into the cell while something else goes out. When something else goes out, its cell is going to go from low concentration to high, which is active transport. We're going to call that a counter-transport mechanism or an antiport. Right? But it's still, what, secondary active transport. The two molecules move in the opposite direction in that particular case. Some nice definitions. Here's a really important slide. It's an exam figure. And you'll see something like this on maybe the first test and even on the last test because it's so important, because it incorporates so much interesting information. Well, what do we have right here? Let's break down the different compartments that I see. Here's blood. And blood, you know, is inside your body, inside of a blood vessel. Then here is a membrane or an epithelium. Actually, epithelium would be a better way. How would you classify this epithelium right here? By layers? What can you tell me about layers? It's simple. That's stratified, right? And it has, these are actually microvilli. Almost look like cilia, not quite, but and they're kind of cuboidal cells, so a simple cuboidal type epithelium. And so here is the basal surface, here's the apical surface. Are these two surfaces the same? Is the apical surface identical to the basal surface when you look at it? No, it's not. The nucleus determines that, right? It changes the shape of the basal surface, changes the shape of the apical. And when you change the shape, what are you changing? Yeah, the function, right? You're changing the function of this membrane compared to this one down here, even though it's the same cell. This epithelium is continuous. These cells are tightly packed together because of this junctional complex. Remember, there's no space between cells in an epithelium generally. So things can't move in the space between cells because there is no space between the cells. The only way things can move across this epithelium is if they actually move through the cell itself. Right? Okay. So here we have blood. And here we have low glucose concentration, and then here we have a sodium potassium ATP pump. And then inside the cell we have high glucose. We'll find out why that is. And as far as sodium goes, should sodium be high or low inside of a cell? Should be low. One of the reasons why is because of that sodium ATP pump is always pumping sodium out. That's why sodium is low right here inside the cell. The third spot that we have is the lumen of a tubule, right? So this is the center of some tube carrying something from one place to another, right? Look up lumen if that's not making sense. This could be the small intestine, the lumen of the small intestine, or it could be a kidney tubule, and anything in this lumen of a kidney tubule is going to end up in urine and you're going to excrete it, right? So this is going to be waste product, and then this is inside your body. All right, so we got sodium. Low inside the cell, we have sodium high outside. So which way will sodium want to just diffuse? From high to low. Sodium will want to be drawn inside the cell. It can't unless it has a carrier protein. And here is a particular carrier protein, but it's a co-transporter, which means that the movement of sodium inside the cell can be used to move glucose. And glucose goes from low to high. Sodium goes from low to high. Is that active or passive process? Active. You see ATP being used right here. You see ATP being used right here at this protein. Not anywhere else in the cell. I see your heads going, no, that's fantastic. All right, so ATP is not being used. So what kind of active transport is this? Because it's going, right, it's going from low to high. It's got to be active. That is secondary active transport because there's no ATP being used up. All right, now we got glucose. With high concentration, low in the blood, will glucose want to go into the blood? Does it require energy? High to low? No. It will diffuse. Can't get through the cell membrane. It needs a little transporter right here. Could you name this transporter that allows for diffusion of glucose to take place? We call that, right there, facilitated diffusion, right? Facilitated diffusion. And then, lastly, over here, the sodium-potassium pump, right? Potassium gets put into the cell. We're not so concerned about that. But sodium, the sodium that entered from this lumen over here gets kicked into the blood. maintaining a low sodium concentration. So there is a gradient of sodium from the lumen of this tubule to the inside of the cell. Right, so that is an energy source that's used to move glucose from low to high concentration. All right, so tell me once again, what kind of active transport is this right here? Secondary. What kind of active transport is this? Without reading it, that's primary because you see ATP, and hopefully that stands out for you. Right, so that. So go ahead, analyze that slide again. If you have to listen to the lecture again, I think I'm recording it. I'm good. But why am I bad? I'm really bad. Because here's your sign-in sheet. And I think it's too late to pass it around. I don't think everybody can sign it in the time for class. Okay. So next time, remind me. I have Thursday right here, so next time remind me and I'll pass the sign-in sheet around. We're going to start with bulk transport on Thursday. And bulk transport is active. It's another form of active transport.